this is Allison Sheridan of the NosillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, September 27th, 2009, and this is show number 225. I'm afraid this is not going to be a NosillaCast-a-thon this week, but it's going to be a great show. How come none of you noticed that there was no outro music last week? I noticed it. But I noticed it after I noticed there was no intro music. I added the intro music, but then I'd uploaded it, and it turns out Libsyn charges you based on how much upload you have, and I was out of bandwidth because of how long that show was. So I'm glad nobody noticed that time. So anyway, let's dig in. It is time to announce the winners of the Camtasia for Mac giveaway. As always, I make a smart mailbox that sorts all of the entries for me. Then I drag each of the email addresses into an Excel spreadsheet after the time is up. Then to the left of the names, I insert an Excel command that is equals rand, open parentheses, close parentheses. This generates a random number. These numbers are 16 significant digits long. Now, you can't sort at this point. I tried, and that doesn't work, because the random numbers regenerate themselves when you do that. So next, I have to copy that number column and do what's called paste special. And in there, you can choose paste values. That gets rid of the formula and formats them as regular numbers instead. Now I can sort on that column, and the top two are the winners. I am pleased to announce that the winners are Jose Rivera and Mark Badawi. Have trouble pronouncing his last name. Well, one of the reasons I really like doing these giveaways is not just that you get free stuff. I mean, don't get me wrong, that's cool. But also that people write the most lovely letters when they're hoping to win. No, seriously, many of you are shy and haven't ever written, and the chance to win spurs you to write these the nicest things. So you figure, heck, I should tell her how much I like the show while I'm at it begging for free stuff. It does bring the shyer of you out of the woodwork, and I enjoy that very much. Now, Mark has written to me lots of times before, but I still like the body of his message. It simply said, please, please, please.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, this week's dumb question comes from Jeremy. Hi, Al. Keep up the Euro bias in your show. It gives it that je ne sais quoi. Well, it would if you could get the Belgians to speak French. Though I guess they're from the Flemish, not Wallon part of Belgium. Anyway, here's a really dumb question for you to answer when you have a slot to fill. What are smart folders? How and why are they used? Regards as ever, Jeremy. Well, funny you should mention smart folders right now, because I just mentioned them in Camtasia for Mac giveaway. Smart folders are a way of creating a folder that follows some rules to sort things out for you. So let's use the Camtasia contest, for example. I want to have every email that has in its subject the word Camtasia all sorted into a nice little folder in Mail. Okay, in this case, technically they're called smart mailboxes instead of smart folders, but they look like folders to us, so we're just going to work with that, okay? To create this smart folder, all I do is in Mail, I select Mail, New Smart Mailbox, and then I name it. And then you define the parameters of the smartness. In this example, I choose Contains Messages That Match All of the Following Conditions. And then the conditions I chose were Subject Contains Camtasia. I also unchecked Include Message from Trash and Sent. I don't want to get all the ones I threw away. And don't worry, I didn't throw away any entries, but like if I wrote something about Camtasia, I would throw it away. Then there's a ton of variables in there to mess with, so you can set your parameters to meet any of your needs. I mean, there's tons of things. You can just keep hitting the plus button and add more parameters. Let's do another example. Let's say you're working on a project called Titanic. You want to make sure that all of the files related to Titanic that you've written in the last week show up in a folder together. You could go into the Finder and select File, New Smart Folder. Kind of looks like Spotlight here, which is not a coincidence. I'll tell you about that later. Type Titanic in the search window and then select where you want it to search. So you can choose a volume or a folder, any place you want. And you also tell it whether you want files whose names include Titanic or any files with the word Titanic anywhere inside them. Once you do this, you get a save button showing in the upper right corner under the search window along with a plus sign. If you hit that plus sign, you now have additional parameters to narrow the search. So, for example, you can choose last open date is within 7 days. So that would give us all files within a certain folder that had the word Titanic anywhere in them that had been created or opened in the last 7 days. When you do hit save, it puts that lovely smart folder down at the bottom left of your Finder window under the indicator Search For. It turns out, of course, you can create these on the fly whenever you use the search box in a Finder window. Do your search, and then click Save, and you're done. They're enormously useful when you need them, and when you don't need them, just delete them. One last point. I'm pretty sure there is something like this in Windows 7. I remember hearing about it, and I want to say they call them libraries. I'm not sure, but for the life of me, I just can't remember exactly what they are, but I'm pretty sure there's a feature like that in Windows 7. Bruce wrote in a comment on the blog after the discussion on Chit Chat Across the Pond when we talked about WordPress. He asked me what WordPress plugins I like and recommend. I'm not going to do an exhaustive discussion on this because I would suspect that it would bore many of you to tears. So I'll just go through them quickly, telling you the problem to be solved and then the plugin I use to solve it. The very first thing you'll find when you start blogging is that comment spam will bury you almost immediately. So before you install a single other plugin, start with Akismet from akismet.com. When you go in and do that, you have to do this slight weird fiddling thing with what they call an API key. You have to go to WordPress.org and get an API key. It's a little bit weird, but once you do it, you set it and forget it. The service is free, and I find I only get about maybe 2 spams a week I have to deal with, and that's probably on an active week. Okay, second one. Now, you've been putting your heart and soul into your blog. What if your web hosting company went belly up? Would you be able to recreate your blog somewhere else? Or what if you personally botched it up and deleted an important directory? How exactly would you feel? I bet you'd feel fine if you were smart enough to install the plugin WordPress Database Backup from, and boy, this can be hard to pronounce, ilfilosofo.com. And of course, as always, there's a link in the show notes. This little plugin does one thing and does it well. It simply emails you a backup of your blog content every single week. Now, you might think that would be an enormous file, but I'm not kidding you here. With my 224 shows as of last week and my ludicrously long blog posts, the entire file is only 2.3 megabytes. Turns out text is very, very tiny, so it's not bad at all. Now remember, this doesn't back up your theme or any ancillary files like images you may have FTP'd up on the side. It's simply the content you've written in your blog. So once in a while, you want to drag the whole mess down so you're sure you have everything. On the sidebar of your blog, you've got all the pages you've created. You know, the permanent things you like to keep visible, like About Me. Because let's face it, we bloggers are all narcissists, right? About Me. And right below that, there's usually Contact Me. Following a theme here? Well, if you're anything like me, you'll keep thinking of new pages to create, like Make Your Own Haunted Bob commercial. And pretty soon, you end up with so many links down the side that people can't see your PayPal button anymore. I installed a plugin I got from research assistant Niraj. By the way, it's insane at finding cool plugins. You ever need a plugin, you just ask him. He can find plugins that do anything. Anyway, the plugin he suggested was called WP DTree from Ulf Benjaminson. And I gave a link in the show notes. It's real long to that one. So if you want to see some other crazy WordPress plugin action going on, check out his website at ulfben.com. He's doing some nutty stuff. So anyway, WP DTree gives the little flip-down menus that I have down in my sidebar. Well, I have one more plugin that I really like, but I have no idea whether it's providing any value at all. I'd like to know from you whether you've ever used it. So here's the problem to be solved. You've just read the best NoSillaCast post ever, and you wish upon a star there was an easy way to tell your entire network about it. I installed a little plugin called Tell a Friend from socialtwist.com. This playful little plugin puts a button at the bottom of the post that lets you post to just about every social network I've ever heard of, and heck, a few I haven't heard of. It's got Twitter, Facebook, MySpace, LinkedIn, Identa.ca, FriendFeed. Heck, you can email it, bookmark it, IM it. Any way you want to tell people about the great and wonderful NoSillaCast is right at your fingertips. Again, let me know if any of you guys have ever pushed that button. I think it's cool and it's kind of cute looking. I just don't know if anybody ever uses it. So iPhones and iPod Touches have a great web browser, but when viewing a text-filled site like mine, they may find it a bit too hard to read. To solve this, I actually have a theme installed called IW Phone from Content Robot at contentrobot.com. All you have to do as a web developer is throw this theme in your themes folder and voila. Anytime an iPod Touch or iPhone user navigates to your site, they get a very simple rendition of your content. It looks really good. Let's say you go to my site and you leave a comment. How do you know if I wrote back to you or if someone else made a comment on your comment? Not very rich experience if you have to keep coming back to see what's going on, if anything. Well, because I use the plugin called Subscribe to Comments from txfx.net, you can click a little checkbox when you leave a comment, even if you haven't left a comment. And whenever someone does leave a comment, you'll get an email notification. I really love it when sites have this enabled, so I did it for my site. You can also go back and uncheck that, so if people start blathering on months later, they're still talking about something you don't care anymore, you can make it stop. I'm pretty sure that Debbie T from SplashOfStyle.com turned me onto this one. So bloggers are always looking for instant gratification for all their work, and there's nothing like a boost to the ego or a stake through your heart than looking at your blog stats. I use Ultimate Google Analytics from, oratransplant.nl to see my statistics. Now don't break my heart, guys. Keep my stats up. Come on, please, keep coming back. Anyway, the plugin does require you to put a little line of code at the bottom of your theme file, so it's not as plug-and-play as some of the plugins I've talked about, but it works really well. So I'm glad you asked me to go through this, Bruce, because I decided if a plugin wasn't worth talking about here, it wasn't worthy of keeping on my blog. So Bart will be glad to know that I deactivated a whole bunch of plugins that were probably just sludging things up. I even found one that I thought I was using that I'm pretty sure was hooked to like a link farm or something. I'm not sure what it was. When I clicked on the where it came from, it was pretty dodgy. So I should have paid attention. I'm going to do it right now. I keep forgetting to mention one of the coolest parts about screen steps. A lot of people respond really well to video, so there's a tendency to want to make video screencasts to teach people techniques. And now we have a lot of great options both on the Windows and the Mac to do just that. There's nothing like a video to get that aha moment for people. There's two problems with video, though. Number one, it's really time-consuming to make long instructional videos. And secondly, when the video is done, what if they forget a step? They have to scrub all the way through the video looking for that spot right where you told them that specific step. Well, how about having the best of both worlds? What if you could have text picture-based instructions with video snippets for the tricky bits? Well, Screen Steps can do just that. Create your tutorial in Screen Steps using the fantastic built-in screenshot utility, and then embed the video that you've uploaded already to a video sharing site like YouTube or another one of them. And now the people you're trying to explain things to, like your dad, your brother, your boss, they can all have a document to which they can refer back to quickly and then scan for the missing step. But they also have the video for that aha moment. Video embedding is available in the Pro and Standard versions too. So if you want to give this a try, head over to screensteps.com and download the free trial. Be sure to use my coupon code when you can't resist the urge to buy it. And that coupon code is NOCILLA, my name spelled backwards, all capital letters, for 25% off the purchase price. There are so many great applications for the Mac, but sometimes you want to get rid of an application. I know, that seems harsh, but sometimes it just has to be done. For literally decades, when I had to remove an application, I simply dragged it to the trash and nothing went wrong that day. But over the years, crud left behind could cause inconsistent behavior that you could never track down, and the extra files on which that application depended were taking up valuable disk space. A few years ago, one of my favorite shareware developers, Reggie Ashworth, invented a shareware program called AppDelete, whose job it was to go sweep up all the little bits an application would normally leave behind, plists and all that kind of stuff. I put AppDelete in the menu bar of my Finder window, so all I have to do is drag the application onto it and the whole mess gets deleted in one fell swoop. Well, I got an email this week from Reggie telling me that AppDelete 3.0 has been completely rewritten from the ground up. I was reading over Reggie's What's New list, and he's taken some giant steps forward. Not only does it get rid of applications, but it does widgets, preference panes, plugins, and screensavers. So picture this. In the old days, I never really launched AppDelete. I would simply drag the apps onto the AppDelete icon. But now that it can do so much more, it has its own interface. I launched App Delete, and now I see buttons for Apps, Others, Orphans, Log, and Undo. Clicking on the Applications button brings up a gorgeous heads-up display that shows all of your applications in your Applications folder. It's very, very pretty and pleasing. At this menu, you can select more than one application and do a search on it, and App Delete then tells you what it would delete should you choose to take that step. This is kind of creepy, but it'll even tell you what it would delete if you chose to delete App Deletes itself. I wasn't crazy enough to actually try that, of course, but I did push the button to see if it could find it. Click on Others, and you get to see all of the dashboard widgets you have loaded. I don't know if you realize this, but having tons of widgets can cause your Mac to slow way down, because many of them check the web for information, and you don't really want that. I plan on getting rid of a whole bunch of widgets, because I don't use hardly any of them. Except, of course, the NoSilicache dashboard widget, of course. I give you a download from podfeet.com if you've forgotten about the NoSilicache dashboard widget. It's actually kind of hard to say. Well, next up, you have Orphans. I'm not quite sure what you're supposed to do with them. Click on one and click Search, and it shows you that it's all alone. Well, it was an orphan. Makes sense that it's all by itself. Well, that's what happened with the few I checked out. Maybe others have other things with them, but then why would they be an orphan? Maybe orphans are leftover little bits that aren't connected to any applications. That might make sense. There's a log button so you can view what you've deleted recently. Oddly, my log showed that I had deleted GarageBand on August 30th, but I only installed App Delete 3.0 a few days ago, and since Snow Leopard came out on the 28th of August, pretty sure I didn't toss out GarageBand 2 days later after I installed it. Maybe there was an upgrade. Ah, actually, that might be it, but I didn't delete it with App Delete. I don't think. Anyway, I deleted a widget and looked at the log again, and it dutifully noted the deletion that I had just done. The last button is a lovely undo. Makes you feel all warm and fuzzy that it's there if you need it. If you're on Snow Leopard, you can run App Delete 2 or App Delete 3. But of course, you want to take advantages of all the new goodies in App Delete 3. If you're a pre-Snow Leopard user, you want to stick with App Delete 2. The good news is Reggie plans to continue updating version 2, so it's still worth it to buy if you haven't already done so. If you're new to App Delete, it's going to cost you $7.99. Or if you're upgrading from version 2, it'll be $3.99. And version 2 from scratch is $5. Heck, there's even a free trial. Check it out at ReggieAshworth.com. So you all know how much I hate PowerPoint, right? Death to PowerPoint and all that. And I think I've talked about how much I love Excel. Get me going on a good pivot table and I'm happy for hours. Just this weekend, I took Lindsay's phone bills on Verizon for the last 3 months, dumped them into Excel, did some pivot table action, I color-coded things, I figured out a way to save her some money on her bill. Heaven. Probably spent an hour and a half. It was a blast. So I got the big hate on for Microsoft PowerPoint. I got the geek love for Excel. What about the third in the triumvirate? What about Microsoft Word? Well, just as you might suspect, it's smack dab in the middle. I simply don't care about it at all. I don't hate it. I don't love it. I just don't care. The main reason I don't care is that I write most things in blogs or in wikis. I like the openness and the ability for others to help me edit. I also don't have a great need for some of the fancy pants things Word offers, like auto-generated tables of contents, footnotes, and all that stuff. I know there's a lot of people who do complicated documents where this is crucial to them, but I think for most of us, Word is probably overkill. Well, back in episode 200, I reviewed a site called opensourcemac.org, and in there I found a product called Bean, and I said, huh, what's Bean? That's a word processor. I think I'll start using Bean for a while and see what it's like. Well, you know, I always have these grand plans and then some shiny new toy drops in my lap and I get distracted and I forgot all about it. I finally decided that it's time to take a close inspection of Bean. Most open source applications work well, but the one thing that isn't a significant focus usually is the user interface. Frequently, they're kind of dodgy and nasty looking, kind of this pre-Soviet war era kind of look to it, you know, really, really nasty. But that's definitely not the case with Bean. It is open source, but I actually went back and verified it was open source before I started the review because I started doubting it based on how good it looks. The toolbar was very pretty and has obvious icons for the classic functions like save, print, undo, and redo. One thing it's missing is a new button. I really like the new button, and there wasn't one there, and you can't add it. Well, there's a nice big magnifying glass for find, and that comes with the classic search and replace functions as well. There's a view button that simply toggles between the view, where, you know, the one where you can see each page and margins, and then the other one where it looks just like a big white piece of paper. I'm sure there's some technical name for those two views, but it kind of escapes me at the moment. Well, next up on the toolbar is a define button with a picture of a dictionary. This will be more useful, I think, when you're reading someone else's document in Bean. If you select a word and hit the define button, it brings up the Apple Dictionary with the definition. I guess it could be handy if you were looking for, say, a synonym. It also, you can toggle to the thesaurus, so that's kind of handy too. There's a get info button that tells you things like number of words, characters, and my favorite, number of carriage returns. For those of you who may be of the younger persuasion, the term carriage return comes from the typewriter days. The paper in the typewriter was wrapped around a cylindrical carriage that would move horizontally along while the typing occurred on the paper. When the carriage reached the end, the typist would reach up, grab a metal handle, and return it back to its starting position. You know, I asked an ergonomist a while ago why typists back in the typewriter days didn't get repetitive stress injuries. He suggested that that simple act of reaching up to pull the carriage back would give you enough interruption in your motion every few seconds to give the hands the rest they needed. Maybe we need to bring back the carriage so we can return it. When I was around 11 years old, I had some kind of long-term illness. I don't remember what it was now, but I was dreadfully bored, so my mother brought me her circa 1945 typewriter and her typing instruction book from school. I went through page by page, and I taught myself to type from that book. It was actually one of the best things I ever did, considering now I'm a really fast typist, and that comes in very handy. I was so bored, though, that when I finished the whole book, I started to teach myself to type with my toes. I have very, very flexible toes. That's part of the pod feet thing. Unfortunately, I recovered from my illness, and that dream was never fully realized. Okay, wait. Back to Bean. Where was I? We were talking about Bean. Oh, yes. We're in the Get Info button panel. After counting things like my beloved carriage return, there's a section on file info that I found very useful. From this pane, you can create a locked file template. You can save the file as read-only so it's not editable, and then there's two options for creating backups of your file. You can choose to have a backup created whenever you close the file, and also to have a backup saved every 5 minutes. And by the way, that time frame is changeable. It has, when you do one of those backups, it has a timestamp on it, so you can actually go back and pull a specific backup by when it was backed up. These backup options are for the file you're currently working on, but if you go to the Bean preferences, you can also set them for all your documents as you create them. I think the inspector button in the toolbar might be my favorite button of all. The inspector gives you nearly infinite control of how your text looks in your document. Font and style are obvious ones, everybody has that. And then the font size is available as a slider that affects your text real time as you slide it. Anything you have selected, it's going to change size, which is fun. You can highlight text in various colors from the menu as well. The crazy variability you offer you next is in spacing. You can change character spacing, line spacing, interline spacing, before and after spacing, left and right, and first line indents, and even set limits to font for the line heights to least or most certain values. It's so much variability. Now, I know we don't need all those functions most of the time, but it was really fun to grab those sliders and watch my text spreading out and shrinking, and I basically made a whole mess of the whole thing. There is a default button at the bottom that I was really hoping would put all my text back to normal, but unfortunately it only fixed one of the functions. I think if they're going to give us that much ability to bork up our text, they ought to at least show us what normal settings would look like. I think just a button for that. That would be good. The last functional button in the Bean toolbar allows you to insert a picture into your text. This works perfectly, but I think the icon is upside down. It has a down arrow on it, implying you would download a picture from here. I think the function is really more like an upload, right? Well, I'm actually trying to find things to nitpick about Bean, because I can't find that much to complain about. So that's probably kind of a nit that the icon's upside down. So what fun would a Mac app be if you didn't have a customize button as well? You can customize that toolbar with tons more options. You can throw in complete, float, full screen, date, time, show invisibles. The list goes on and on. I'll let you go play with all of those. You can select a Bean document, send right to mail, which works really, really well, at least with mail.app. You click send to mail, and it just opens up mail with it as an attachment, puts a name in it. It's great. I'd be curious if it works as well with applications like Thunderbird, if that was your chosen default mail utility. I was hunting through the menus, and then I found the most wondrous menu choice of all. You can resize images in your document with a slider. Oh, the pure joy of that. It was fantastic. There's an insert menu that gives you choices for numbered and bulleted lists, and this was the first spot that Bean gave me any trouble at all. At first, I couldn't figure out how to get it to stop numbering my paragraphs. I finally figured out that if a line is numbered and you don't want it to be, simply hit the delete backspace key and the numbers disappear, and then you're free to type in your line. I've always found tables in Word to be a bit troublesome. Not that they aren't functional, they just don't work quite the way my brain is wired. I really don't think there's any problem with it. It's just not quite the way I would think of it. I tried out tables in Bean, and setting them up seemed really easy. First time you can see the changes as you're setting them up. The default in the menu is 3 columns and 2 rows. So as you change those numbers, you can see the table changing real time. There's one bit that doesn't work right, in my opinion. In this table setup area, you can choose the color and thickness of the table border, as well as the background color and things like text centering. Unfortunately, it only affects the top left cell right when you're in the process of creating the entire table. This may be a choice they actively made, but I think it's the wrong choice. I didn't select one cell and then go to formatting. I'm building the table from scratch right now. After my table was set up, I was able to select all of it and open Format Table, and then I was able to change all the cells at once. Still, I think they did that backwards. Now, since we have to live in a Microsoft-infested world, it's very important, even to me, that my files be interchangeable with those people still using Word. There's a note in the Bean documentation that is very important. Here's what it says. Bean uses Apple's file conversion services to open and save Word 2007 format files. Please note that due to the limitations of the Apple file format converter, images are lost when opening a native Word 2007 format file in Bean and when saving a rich text document as a Word 2007 format in Bean. Also lost are highlighting, tables, text lists, and advanced paragraph formatting. Sorry, this is how Apple implemented it. The user will be warned of this when overwriting a Word 2007 file, not created by Bean, to prevent loss of information. Bean should not be considered a replacement for Word or any other word processor designed for complex documents involving, for example, citations. Now, this is an important note, but it doesn't answer the question of what happens if you save as, say, native Word 2003 format, plain old .doc. I thought maybe this was related to the .docx format. I wondered, in 2003, do you get to keep your images highlighting in tables? I ran some tests, and evidently the only way you can preserve your images highlighting in tables is by saving the file as RTFD, which is rich text with images, or by exporting it out as a PDF. Word 2003 doesn't keep any of the stuff, the goodies either. So, bottom line, Bean is a beautiful text editor with a spit and polish worthy of a higher-end shareware application, but it's actually open source, so completely free. It launches extremely quickly, has beautiful icons, allows for real-time viewing of interesting changes to the formatting, and it lets you resize images. I have not yet loaded Microsoft Word on my laptops ever since I loaded Snow Leopard from scratch, and I don't see any reason why I would load Microsoft Word. The lack of ability to save documents with images highlighting in tables for edit by others in Word is not really a problem for me, at least. If I want to see them, I can use RTFD or PDF. If I want them to help me edit, then I'd probably be writing in a wiki anyway. That might be a concern for you, though, so keep that in mind. But Bean is now my word processor of choice. You can download Bean from bean-osx.com. My life is very calm and organized, and some may say overly structured and predictable. I wouldn't say that, of course. I like it that way. One of the places you really want predictability is when you turn the key in your ignition on your car, the car starts, and it continues to go all the way to your destination and back. I have that predictability, and I've had it for over 30 years because of one man. And you know who that man is? That man is the internationally famous Honda Bob. He comes to my house, does all the regular maintenance on my Hondas and Acuras, and I never have a worry about them starting and going and coming back. If you live in the LA or Orange County areas and drive a Honda or an Acura, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, it's time for my favorite part of the week. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. How is this Saturday treating you, Bart?
Saturday's treating me absolutely fine. A little tired after having to race home very quickly because the train was late and stuff. But anyway.
What were you photographing this morning?
I was trying to... Well, morning's an interesting term.
Oh, sorry. Afternoon, evening?
No, the weather conditions were perfect for a certain shot I've been hoping to get. So, you know, the train was due at 5:30. That gives me half an hour to get home, which is more than enough time. And at 5:45, the train hadn't come yet. And I was sitting there going, do I wait? Or do I go by, go and be on time for Allison? And I decided to wait. And then 2 minutes later, the train came.
Good.
Which meant if I hadn't waited, I would have just about had my camera packed up and my bag zipped and I would have heard it go by. It would have been, you know, much expletives.
A little bit of grumpiness, huh?
Yeah. So I got the shot anyway. We'll wait to see later if it's any good.
All right. Sounds good. Well, what do we get up for Security Light this week?
Okay, we have a few things. First one was tweeted out by Steve, just sort of pointing us. Perhaps it's not something that should surprise us, but there are people out trying to fish us on Twitter. So it's kind of the usual. In some ways, this is very familiar. They tweet out saying that they're... is this a video of you while, you know, while drunk or whatever? And you immediately go, oh my God, is that on the internet? And you click on it and you get presented with what looks like a Twitter login page. Only it isn't a Twitter login page, it's a bad guy. And then they have your Twitter username and password.
Right.
So it comes down to the fact that you need to be careful. A lot of people don't understand how URLs work, which means that they don't know the difference between... something like www.twitter.com.something or twitter.secure.com or, you know, something that isn't actually a Twitter URL on a Twitter URL. Which bit of the URL is the bit that counts and which bit isn't?
Right,
so,
right.
So it might be a good excuse to talk about that. And also to say that this is one area, just one I know of, where Internet Explorer users are at an advantage.
What? Oh, come
I know,
on.
It's shock. Now, Internet Explorer has one feature that I really want to see everyone else adopt. In the address bar, the domain part is bolded.
Oh.
So that if you're on paypal.com, it should be paypal.com in bold and not something else. And if it's something else, then you've been conned.
Now, should you be looking for HTTPS in a case like that?
Not really, no, because if you're on the bad guy's... if you're on the wrong domain, whether or not you're securely talking to the bad guys or insecurely talking to the bad guys, the problem is you're talking to the bad guys.
Oh, okay. So they could have https://twitter.garbage.com?
Yeah, if they own garbage.com, then they can get an SSL cert.
Okay, so HTTPS doesn't save us.
Yeah, subdomains don't matter. Anyone can, you don't buy subdomains. You're free to just make them. So you could make paypal.podfeet.com. Nothing whatsoever to stop you. Wouldn't have to spend a cent.
Wow.
And then if you put an SSL cert on podfeet.com, which you're 100% entitled to,
right,
you could then have twitter.podfeet.com with HTTPS without any errors. But the reason that you should not enter your Twitter password on such a page is because it's at podfeet.com, not twitter.com.
Right. Okay.
So I thought we should explain to people how the structure works. So the first thing you do if you're trying to figure out what domain you're actually at is anything after the slash... throw it in the bin. Ignore it. It's irrelevant.
Right.
So another trick people will do is have badguy.com/www.twitter.com/something. Anything after the forward slash is just a file name. They just happen to call a file www.twitter.com.
Okay. All right.
So everything after the first slash, ignore it. It's just a file name. The HTTPS, the HTTP, anything :// at the front, knock that off as well. And then you should just be left with a bunch of stuff separated by dots, which is the domain name.
Okay.
And the important thing is domain names do not read from left to right. They read from right to left.
Hmm.
So you'll have a top-level domain name on the far right, which will be something like com, org, edu,
IE
for Ireland, yeah, EE for Belgium. Or sometimes there are compound TLDs. You'll see co.uk, com.au is another popular one.
That's Australia,
AC.
right?
AC.uk. Com.au is commercial sites in Australia. Co.uk is commercial sites in the UK.
Oh, I always wonder what that was.
AC.uk is one that really confuses people. It's the equivalent of .edu in the States. It's academic community in the UK, AC.uk. So all the universities will be something that, you know, Nottingham.ac.uk or whatever.
But you don't to know all of that, right? Because it's that last couple of characters, two or three.
It's either the last three dot something in three long, apart from info, which is four long, and biz, which is four long. They're starting to change.
Wait, biz is last three.
So it's just that info then.
Okay.
And maybe .co.uk or whatever, but it's whatever comes after that is really the bit they've paid for.
So it's that last dot.
So it's, well, at the very end you have the top level domain and you can ignore that, and then's the bit they paid for.
Okay.
So if that isn't, if that is anything other than what you're expecting it to be, doesn't matter if something more to the left is right, that's just a subdomain. That means nothing. The bit they paid for is what matters. So in this case, just looking at the link that Steve sent out, they have a URL that looks semi-believable because it's http://videos.twitter.secure-logins01.com. Sounds believable if you don't understand how domain names work.
Right.
So you strip off everything after the slash. Well, there's nothing after the slash. You strip off the HTTP, so we're with videos.twitter.secure-login01.com. Com is the TLD. Ignore that. So the bit they actually paid for was secure login 01.
Ah. Well, that sounds secure.
The videos and the Twitter, they're just subdomains that anyone could have put on their subdomain. So they didn't pay for that. That gives them nothing. So the actual domain you're talking to is secure-login01. And there's no reason to have a trust relationship with that domain because that is not Twitter.
Right, right, right.
So something.twitter.com is fine. Twitter.something.com is not. And they'll usually pick something that sounds somewhat believable, like secure-logins01. Yeah, that sounds good. I'll have me some secure.
Yeah, that sounds secure, absolutely. Now, what I do instead of spending a terrible amount of time studying it, I mean, I'll usually take a look and I can pretty much tell, like you said, but just in case, instead of hitting those links, or I might hit the link and go see what it takes me to, I'll go to the URL bar and type in twitter.com or https://twitter.com. I'll actually type it in to make sure I'm going to the thing I think I'm going to.
Yeah, but that won't help if they're linking to a specific video that claims to be of you while drunk.
Ah, that's true.
Or worse.
But I know that's not out there.
Yeah, if it doesn't exist, it can't possibly be out there.
Well, that's good. I think that can probably help a lot of people keep from getting phished. The big problem, of course, is a lot of people are using these, you know, bit.ly or dig shortened URL things, right?
Yeah, which is even more dangerous. Because if someone says, oh, there's a video of you on Twitter, you click on a link that you don't see, and then you're on a page that looks like Twitter, how many people look up to the address bar?
Right.
I mean, and there's no reason they couldn't have a secure cert on this dodgy domain because there's no reason they aren't entitled to an SSL cert for secure-login01.
Yeah, I'm glad you cleared that up because I thought before that if it had an HTTPS, I was okay, that they were somehow vetted by, you know, the society of people who know who bad people are or something.
No, what it means is that they are who they say they are. So if they say that there is something.secure-login01, they can have an SSL cert for secure-login01. Because that's who they are. You're just, you know, it doesn't provide any sort of trust. It just says that this URL is definitely who you're talking to. But in this case, you're definitely securely talking to the bad guys. You know, not good.
I see. Okay.
Right.
I think we have a second one, don't we?
We do indeed. This is a slight scolding for people, I think. Research came out from a company that do advertisements in iPhone apps, and so they, every time someone runs these apps and an ad gets displayed, it obviously gets a log entry on their web server. And of course, as with any web browser, the browser identifies itself on the OS. So they can see in their logs what versions of the iPhone OS are talking to them.
Right.
And what they see is not what they should be seeing. what they see is that only a very small percentage, 23%, have actually updated to the latest version of the iPhone OS.
Ooh.
Which means that 77% are at browsing the web. They're clearly connected to the internet, because if they weren't connected to the internet, they couldn't possibly have gotten this. They couldn't possibly have connected to this ad server.
Sure.
So these are people using the internet on a device that is full of known vulnerabilities. They are not patched. This is every bit as stupid as wandering around with an unfixed, unpatched Windows install. It's every bit as deadly, every bit as likely to get you seriously buggered.
You know what I think the problem probably is that the iPhone now does so much over the air that you don't actually need to plug it into iTunes very often. So let's say, I mean, you can download podcasts without connecting to your computer. You can get your email. You can get your address book synced. I probably haven't plugged my iPhone into my computer in weeks. I mean, the only reason I did it was because you told me there was an iPhone update. So I would never have known that. I think maybe they need to push some notifications to the iPhone itself saying, hey, go plug this in, you moron. There's an update. Because how are other normal people going to know?
That's a really good idea.
Yeah.
Well, they can listen to Security Lite, of course, and we'll tell them.
Well, I'm sure Apple's listening. Apple, why don't you guys institute that? I think it would be a swell idea. I think they may need to do something like that.
Yeah. Thankfully, there's only, I say the word very loosely, there's only 26% of people on iPhone OS 2.
Jeez.
Yeah, they're really, 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 really hosed if anything ever comes out. I mean, so far there's nothing actively exploiting all the known vulnerabilities. And, you know, once Apple patches them and releases the details, attacking them becomes easier. Because now we know what the problem is.
Right.
We know where to look. So that's why it's really important to update. Because, you know, yeah, the vulnerabilities were there and no one had attacked them before. But now that we all know about them, they're way, way riper to be attacked.
By the way, they just pushed a thing to us telling us that we should connect up to our computers because now we could get MMS in the United States. So apparently getting MMS was really important to let us know about, but this security flaw was not.
Well, actually, there's something. Our provider here is O2, and they broadcast a text message when iPhone OS 3 came out telling us all to go and update.
Hmm. So they can.
But it was them, not Apple. Yeah, well, they just SMS all their customers. I mean, they know who we are.
Right.
They know our phone number. They sold it to us.
Actually, that's true of the MMS thing, too, because it was AT&T that was telling us about it. But I'm sure Apple could say, hey, AT&T, could you put a message out that says this?
Yeah. Although that could get interesting, because who then pays for the SMS?
Oh, the SMSs are free that we get that tells us, or the message.
No, they're for you, but they're not free for the provider. It takes up space and stuff. I mean, it's a resource they would normally sell to companies, to the right to SMS people.
Yeah, but it's security and they're in bed together.
Yeah, but how would you feel if you were a company providing a service and Apple's are telling you how you should use your resources? Do you think there might be a bit of pushback?
I guess it would depend on what they were asking it for. You know, if it was like, hey, we want to tell everybody about the new nanos. Yeah. I can see that, but it's like, okay, you guys, you know, we're in this together and this system has a vulnerability and, you know, they're your customers too. You're kind of in bed with each other on that one. I think it's necessary. I can't imagine saying no to that, going, no, Apple, you have to pay for this.
Yeah, but you're a reasonable human being.
That's true. I forgot they're all rat bastards, right?
You're not an exec in a phone company. I mean, they're a different class of people. They have to be.
Yeah.
How else can they sleep at night?
Well, I'm sure some of them are lovely.
I'm sure they're either oblivious or they're evil. They have their choice.
That's pretty harsh.
Well, I'm sorry, but they charge a lot of money for a rubbish service, and any chance they get, they screw you over for some more.
Okay, let's say this. I think the people who are developing the policies probably are that way. But I've talked to some very lovely AT&T people on the phone. Remember I made those 19 phone calls? They aren't evil or oblivious. They may even agree with us.
No, I'm talking about the higher-ups.
Yeah.
People who make their mind to do all these things.
Yes, okay.
So the poor little guy who talks to you on the phone probably feels horrific to tell you all the things they have to tell you.
I would think so, yeah.
And they're the ones who are going to get shouted at.
Right.
Which is kind of fair.
Exactly. Well, that's business. All right. So that's enough. Oh, wait. There was one more bit on that. What happens to the iPod Touch owners who have to pay to get a security update?
This makes me annoyed. Right. I understand Sarbanes-Oxley, and I understand that Apple have to charge for new functionality, which is perfectly fine, and if we don't like it, blame Congress. That's fine. But there is no law whatsoever preventing Apple from bringing out security updates to the older versions of the iPhone OS. They sold those to people. They have a responsibility, in my mind, to keep those people safe. They should. It is not acceptable to hold people to ransom, where the choice is be insecure or give us more money. To me, that's blackmail.
Right. Yeah,
money, whatever you want to look at it, it's just not on.
You would think they could separate it, you know, if it has a security update, then you give it to people for free. It seems like you should be able to do that in spite of Sarbanes-Oxley, don't you think?
Well, completely. That's not new functionality. That's fixing a flaw in what you sold them already. They did it for iPhone OS 1. There were more versions of 1.x came out after 2.0 came out so that the people on the iPod Touch could remain secure but not get the goodies in 2.0.
Okay.
And they just did not do that this time around.
Well, wait. So the security update was 3.1, though, and the paid-for update was 3.0.
Yeah, no. But when 2.0 came out, there was a new version of 1 released as well that did not contain the new functionality but had all the fixes that were in 2.0.
So are you saying this 3.1 update that fixes this problem doesn't fix 2.0?
No, it doesn't. And when 3.0 came out...
There isn't a 2.0.1?
No, there isn't. And when 3.0 came out, it was full of security stuff, and the 2.x people were not given an option to upgrade. They were not given a security update. So the choice was either be vulnerable or buy 3.0. Now, once you had 3.anything, 3.1 is free. But to get the two people were completely abandoned at 3.0 and abandoned again at 3.1. So they're now two security updates behind, and they have no choice in the matter. Either pay your money... or you're in danger. Well, that sounds awfully like a protection racket to me.
Now, you can see if you go way back in time, that starts to just be reality, right? I mean, you can't really expect...
Sure.
I heard, I don't remember which podcast it was, but they were saying it was unconscionable that Microsoft wasn't still patching Windows 98. It's, come on, you know, seriously, if it was...
Yeah, what is reasonable... Well,
right.
If you look at it this way, Steve Jobs has said that the iPod Touch is a computer in your pocket. Would it be acceptable for Apple to stop supporting Tiger the moment Snow Leopard came out? Leopard came out? It would not be. It would be utterly untolerated. Right now, Apple are supporting three versions of their hardware, of their desktop OS, which go back a lot further than the launch of the iPhone.
Right.
Tiger is a lot older than the iPhone. And then on the iPhone, it's either be on the latest or get nothing. We wouldn't tolerate it on the desktop. Why are we tolerating it on a computer in our pocket?
I agree with you. I know that shocks everyone, but I'm in complete agreement with Bart on this one.
The good news is with the changes, it looks like there's some changes in the regulations for Sarbanes-Oxley. So it looks like they're going to be allowed to give out the updates for free and none of this funny accounting practices anymore of having to write off the payments over 24 months.
Right. I don't know that that's actually a change in Sarbanes-Oxley, but the accounting practices for sure. So
there's regulations that tell people how they need to account for things. Otherwise, they're breaking the law and they're changing the regulations. So
you know what I think, though, the effect of that's going to be? It's going to be that the iPhone and iPod Touch people have to pay.
I honestly don't think so. I think no one's going to have to pay, and I think we'll all be better off for it.
Really? See, I think since the iPhone will now be accounted for the same way the iPod Touch is, which the accounting change we're talking about was the iPhone, instead of getting revenue based on a monthly fee, they would get revenue just right up front when they sell a unit. So now what you've done is you made the iPhone accounted for the same way the iPod Touch is accounted for. Mm-hmm. So wouldn't you think the iPhone users would be treated now the way the iPod Touch users were treated?
Well, no, the reason that the iPhone was done on subscription accounting was because they felt they knew they were going to have to put out updates, and they felt that the only way they could cover themselves was to do it on a subscription basis. But now with the rules changed, they can give out the updates without the subscription, and they don't want to do subscription accounting because it's messy and it's more work, and it gives Wall Street an artificially low view of how you're actually doing. Mm-hmm. So it's not in your interest in any way, shape, size, or form. So they only did that accounting practice because they felt they had to. They knew they were going to be issuing updates to the iPhone because it shipped with a half-baked OS.
Mm-hmm.
So now that they don't have to do that anymore, they're not going to do it. I mean, they only ever did the subscription accounting because they had to, and now they don't have to.
I see. Well, let's move on. We have some good news. Back into this story with what went wrong in the first place, to remind people, because we did talk about it on the NewsWire topic. But tell them what went wrong so you can talk about the rest of it.
Okay, so NetNewsWire has a long history. It used to be a paid-for app, and I think it was about $20 or $30. It wasn't cheap, but it was a world-class RSS reader, and I loved it. And so I had paid for it. And then about a year later, after I had paid for it, they decided to go free. So it was identical product. It was just taken over by another company, I believe, at the time. And NetNewsWire has changed hands quite a few times, I think. And so they made it free, completely free, which angered a lot of people because it basically destroyed all the competition. Why would anyone use, I mean, there was nothing as good as NetNewsWire, and now that NetNewsWire was free, why would you use something lesser just because it was free? So they sort of killed the whole market, and it was NetNewsWire all the way. And obviously this didn't work out for them. I don't know entirely how they expected to make money off a free product, but somehow they thought they magically would.
Do you have ads?
No ads, no carry-on like that. It was just a free app, and you got free syncing onto NewsGator's cloud.
Okay.
Which is just insane, because the more popular it became once it became free, the more strain it put on their cloud.
Right.
So they were offering this free service, and I don't see... I mean, the only possible way they could get anything back is through... basically this giving NewsGator a good name and then people buying the corporate level stuff from NewsGator, which is apparently very good.
Okay.
So the only possible way that could have made any money. So shock and or horror, they suddenly realized that this was hemorrhaging money and we're in the middle of a recession. So they decided this had to change. And they just basically decided to kill their cloud. And they decided to stick ads into NetNewsWire. So when they killed their cloud, suddenly NetNewsWire wouldn't synchronize anymore, and everyone loved their syncing. So the developer, Brett Simmons...
Wouldn't sync with what?
Well, NewsGator's cloud is where it always synced to. So with the announcement that the cloud was going, so it was syncing.
I lost you along the lines there. Syncing, usually syncing means, you know, between my iPhone and my iMac, or between my PC and my Mac.
Sync to the cloud so that you could keep... So you go to many computers and iPhone. Ah, so it was an iPhone app. Everything synced to the cloud so that you had the same everywhere.
Ah, I'm with you. Gotcha. Okay.
So when NewsGator killed their cloud, suddenly there was nowhere for NetNewsWire to go, which would have made a lot of people very angry. So the developer decided that the only way out of this was to start syncing it to Google's free Google Reader service.
Okay.
So Google Reader would become the back end to NetNewsWire. And NetNewsWire would become ad-supported. So you pay $10 or get ads. This all sounds fine, but the first time they went to close off the cloud, it was too early. The software was still in beta, and yet they were chasing us off the cloud. With the result that the email we received made it very clear that we should upgrade now, so we all did, and we discovered that we had a piece of beta software that genuinely warranted the label beta. Uh-huh. It was a giant mess.
Oh, no.
So I did it on one machine. It synced its way onto Google Reader, which has no support for subfolders. So my, you know, meticulously organized 200-odd feeds, I think it was 246, were suddenly barfed down into just flat file structure. And it was a complete and utter mess. So I got very annoyed and I stopped using the syncing. And I started only using NetNewsWire on one computer, which is really annoying and really awkward. But I struggled on. And now it's come out of, now the client is finally ready. So now we can update to the latest version, which all sounds good. And through some clever jiggery pokery, he's actually added in support for subfolders in NetNewsWire, even though Google Reader doesn't support it.
Oh,
so it's actually folder name dash folder name dash folder name, and when it's shown in NetNewsWire, those dashes get broken up in the subfolders.
Oh, cool!
So, I mean, it's a simple, it's a trivially simple idea.
Nice little hack. Right.
It's a lovely little hack, and it works perfectly. So within NetNewsWire, you now have all your subfolders, and you can collapse them in all the ways you always could, and it's fantastic.
Great.
And so now it's syncing to NetNewsWire, or to Google Reader. But unfortunately, I was suspicious, and I'm glad I was suspicious. So I took a backup of all of my subscriptions. You can export a list of RSS feeds as something called an OPML file.
Right.
So I had exported everything I had as an OPML file, and I'd made sure to include the grouping. So you have a choice of an OPML flat file or an OPML grouped file, and the grouped file will have your subfolders. So I luckily I exported it as an OPML grouped file, and then I set about updating. So the first time, the ugly, icky beta, what it did was, regardless of... We weren't given any option. The moment you ran it, it replaced everything that happened to be in your Google Reader with what was currently in NetNewsWire, which made people angry because they already had stuff in Google Reader, and it was suddenly wiped out by NetNewsWire, which made people very angry. So now, rather than giving people a choice, they've now gone for a different default you have no control over. Now they just merge. Regardless of what's there, they just merge.
Oh no, this isn't going to be good, because that's going to be all your... This is all your...
Because all my crud from the last failed attempt was still there. So now in go my clean folders and everything, and I end up with two of everything. A complete and utter mess. So it took me quite a lot of time to delete everything, because the syncing with Google Reader doesn't seem to be perfect. If you try to do too many actions, it sort of gets a lot, ties itself in a knot. So when I tried to delete everything, it appeared to be gone. I closed NetNewsWire, opened it again, and 50 subscriptions had come back. So after a lot of messing around, I eventually got them all gone. And then when I opened NetNewsWire, instead of it being empty, I got the default subscriptions.
Oh, no.
Which is about 10 or 15 subscriptions. I was like, I'm trying to empty this so that I can re-import my backup.
Don't put anything in here, right?
I want an empty. So I ended up leaving one subscription behind, which then made it happy, and I exited and entered again and verified that everything was definitely gone apart from this one subscription. Then I imported my backup, but the backup didn't come in straight into my hierarchy. It came in into a subfolder called imported and then today's date. So then I had to move them from that folder back to my root folder, and it would appear again that the syncing is imperfect, because I did that and it all looked fine, and I exited NetNewsWire, loaded myself back into NetNewsWire, and five or six of the folders were back in the export instead of where they should have been. So after another two or three restarts, move one thing, close, come back in, move another, close, come back in, seemed to be the only way to get some of these things to stick, I eventually got all of my subscriptions exactly the way I wanted on one machine. And then I was going to go home and do all this again, and I thought to myself, isn't there a very high possibility I'm about to make a complete and utter pigsty again? Because if I do the same default behavior now, it's going to barf in another load, isn't it?
Absolutely. I'm sure it is.
So I decided, I made up a little dance, as it were, to get around this. So start by unplugging your computer from all networks. Plug out the Ethernet, turn off your airport. Open NetNewsWire, disable syncing, delete everything bar one. Close it, open it again to make sure they've really gone. Then enable syncing, type in your username and password and everything, and then plug back in the network and let it sync. And then you're going to have one dodgy subscription to take back out.
This is insanity, Bart. This is comical how much work you had to do to get this to work.
And it's all because it's missing a trivially simple option that, of all places, Mobile Me shows the way. Which is a strange thing to say. The first time you sync your computer to Mobile Me, you get a dialogue that comes up and it says, gives you three options. The first option is to replace everything on this computer. I don't know which order they're in, but one option is to replace everything on this computer with whatever's in Mobile Me, which is usually what you want to do the first time you sync, because the chances are you're syncing because you're starting syncing because you've nuked and paved, or this is a brand new computer. So you'd like it to just suck down everything from the cloud and make that the same here. The second option you get is to do the opposite. Maybe you've decided that you haven't used Mobile Me for a while and now you're starting up again. So it says, delete everything on Mobile Me and push everything I have to Mobile Me. And then the third option is merge. But NetNewsWire will simply always merge. It doesn't give you an option. That's just what it does. So I really think it needs to have a first run option that just says, merge, push down or pull up.
Right. That seems pretty obvious. That would be just a single button like that would solve all of this problem, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just a matter of some simple common sense. It just needs to prevail here.
One would think. Well, I think that's going to wind us up for this week. You're actually going to leave us next weekend, huh?
Yeah, I'm back off into the sticks, away from proper broadband and stuff. So I'm off to visit my parents again. So it'll be 2 weeks until you have me again. You'll have to find a substitute, Belgian.
Well, actually, I've been hunting around, and I think Gazmaz from the UK is going to help us out next weekend.
Yeah, he'll do. He's a substitute stand in Belgium.
He lives near Belgium, or
the UK is quite close to Belgium. Yeah, there's not much between Dunkirk and, although that's France. Anyway, no, yeah, he's close enough.
Well, see, now technically, all I have to do is find a pond between me and whoever I'm talking to. So I could, like, you know, talk to someone in Iowa and make sure there's a lake between us. That would count.
True. Although with Gazmans, it's two ponds, so it's chit chat across the ponds.
There you go. All right. Well, say hi to Mom and Dad, and I hope you have a good trip, and we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Until then, happy computing.
Well, after Bart and I recorded, and during the recording of IMP Live, where I was a guest on the show, Bart told me that his early optimism on NetNewsWire had turned into a complete bucket of fail. So he's back to not liking NetNewsWire and not recommending it. It's not doing what he wanted it to. So I'm sure next time we talk to him, he'll give us an update on that in the next Chit Chat Across the Pond, in which he joins us. So I want to make a particular thanks here to Will P., who spent 3 hours and 15 minutes on Skype doing a Skype screen sharing session with me to create a script that will completely automate everything I do to the file after I finish the show. So his script does this. It takes the GarageBand the file out of GarageBand, that's an AIFF file. It pulls it into iTunes. It converts it to an MP3. It inserts the logo. It changes the names of the file, like to have my name and the fact that it's a podcast and the name of the podcast. It sets it to skip when shuffling so that it doesn't come in and bother you when you're listening to music. It sets it to remember where you stopped so that when you come back to the show, it's right where it was. Then it, I forgot. After, when it first takes the AIFF file, it runs it through the levelator first, so all the sound levels get perfect. So then it outputs it from GarageBand when it's done with all that, and it ends up with a perfect MP3 file right where I need it. And actually, I think we might be able to take it one step further. I should be able to attach one more little step to it where it'll FTP it up to Libsyn, where I host my files. But anyway, I wanted to give a specific thanks to Will for spending an enormous amount of time and being hilarious the whole time. We had a really, really good time. If you want to check out his work, go over to iwillsite.com, that's S-I-T-E, and be sure to follow him at twitter.com/beiju, that's B-E-I-J-U. And a special shout out to you, Will, that I just can't believe you spent that much time. You know, people often ask me, why do I do it for free? It's because everybody does everything else for me for free, so it's all a big good thing. Thanks a lot, Will. Well, it's time to draw things to a close. I know, the chat room is crying right now. They have so much fun in there every week, mocking me while I juggle this thing and yelling, save, save, because every once in a while I do forget to save and things go badly. But anyway, they have a good time in there, so you should come join the mockery next week. It's every Sunday night at 5 p.m. GMT-8 on Sunday, like I said, at podfeed.com/live. If you'd like to send in dumb questions, comments, praise, shoot me an email at allison@podfeed.com. And of course, be sure to follow me at Twitter at twitter.com/podfeed. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.